You're listening to The Conversation with Adam Weber, lead pastor of Embrace Church and author of Love Has a Name.
Hey guys, it's Adam. You are listening to The Conversation. I hope it's been a great day. I hope you're well. A high five, a hug to some of you that need a hug. As always, I am honored that you are spending any time with me. Hey, I got one quick question before we get into today's episode, and it is this. What is one thing that you have wanted to do that you keep putting off? It might be a small thing. It might be a big thing. It might be like something connected to God. Maybe it's not connected to God. Maybe it's as simple as going to see an old friend that you haven't seen. Maybe it's going fishing with one of your kids. Maybe it's pursuing a dream that you have or applying for a specific job. Maybe it's leading a small group at your church. You've just had this desire. You've wanted to do it, but you've never done it. Maybe it's telling a family member that you simply love them. Whatever it is, I just want to challenge you, if there's any way possible today or sometime this week, go and do it. Stop putting it off. Make the time. Make it a priority. Go and do that thing. Hey, in today's episode, we're talking all things marriage. I was able to sit down with Kevin and Marcia Myers. Kevin is the pastor at a ginormous church called 12 Stone. It's an incredible church. I've visited. We talk all things marriage. We talk about conflict. We talk about trying to change our spouse, which is not a good idea. And they just both talk so candidly about marriage, and there's wisdom being dropped all over the place. And so whether you're married, you want to be married, you're engaged, whatever situation you are in, I know this is going to encourage you. As always, sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation. Kevin and Marcia, a huge honor to sit down with the both of you. People that I've watched from afar for some time. I want to welcome you to the podcast today. Super excited about it.
Thank you.
We're grateful to be here. Very excited to have some time with you and hopefully encourage others in their marriage.
Yeah. So I want to start right into the both of your relationship. If you want to share just kind of the overview on your own individual story and then when the two of you met.
Let's see. I grew up in Michigan, in a small town, with a very faith-filled family, very stable, followed all the precepts. I never had to doubt their relationship or their Christianity. And so really I had one of those, you know, white picket fence kind of upbringings for the most part. Yeah. There's always, you know, going to be a little bit of dysfunction maybe, but mostly good.
And I brought most of the dysfunction into the relationship, Adam. So I came from the home that was dysfunctional. I eventually hit divorce in my middle school years and estranged from my dad for 4 decades and some of that kind of stuff. So I brought the dysfunction in because you can't both have it together.
Yeah.
However, when we met at college, what was your first impression?
Well, we had met in college at a roller skating party. Back then, that was the thing to do for people at a Christian college.
That dates us.
I don't even think they have roller rinks anymore. Anyway, I was standing in line, and it was my freshman year. He was a junior, and he was in front of me, several people. And I remember looking at him, and he was just being very loud and very obnoxious.
You're welcome.
In my opinion. And I was like, oh, you know, he's kind of cute, but nah, I don't think I could ever date him. He's just he's too much for me.
We're still working that out.
Yeah. So you guys meet though each other. What happens? Are you date forever? Kind of quick dating time? Share that part.
We dated for 18 months at college, and then we were married maybe 18, 20 months later.
Yep.
We were married, and it was awesome early happiness. Let's call it that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Prior to kids and life and ministry and craziness. So kind of hit fast forward. So you get married. Was that hard bridging the both of your backgrounds, kind of the white picket fence with the brokenness?
Yeah, surprisingly more difficult. By time I'm studying in for ministry, we're married, we're pastoring. This should go well because we know Jesus. And happy was the early experience. And the reason for the title of this book is precisely our experience. It took us a couple of years to hit ugly. And then I discovered why my parents did divorce. I married a person other than the one I dated.
Yeah, I think it's always about kind of unmet expectations. You kind of expect them to just fall in like your family almost, you know, but they're coming from a completely different place. And so you're constantly in conflict because it's, in your mind, that's not how it's done, whatever it might be.
Yeah. And our seasons of unhappy went deep and long, and it probably took us a decade to figure out the seeds of what sit in the book.
Yes.
It took us that long to figure out that everybody goes from happy. That's why you say I do. You get sucked in. And then after the honeymoon, you experience unhappy, but everybody doesn't rebuild happy, and it's possible. It's how God designed it. It's what everybody has to travel through. So hence the purpose of the book is to give seven practices that help you build a marriage stronger, better than your honeymoon.
Yeah. Before we get to that second happy part, and obviously share as much as you're open to sharing, what did the season of an unhappy look like for each of you individually?
I remember it started with these little sniping comments that reflect the disappointment. Mm-hmm. Until eventually it's a full-blown conflict. And you look back years later and you realize, I can't remember what we fought over. I can just remember that we fought. We were at odds. Mm-hmm. And she was disappointing to me. And I was trying to help her become who I imagined her to be. And for some reason, she wasn't excited about that. So honestly, Adam, we fought about money and budgeting. We fought about decision making. What about the one where I would invite people over? Like, this is a classic.
Yeah, for sure. He would just out of the blue, of course, we're pastoring, so we would meet people at church, and then he would just invite them over to our house. Like, without any, it would be like I'd be standing there and he'd bring them over and say, "Hey, these people are going to come over tonight. Isn't that awesome?"
And like, to me, right now.
Yeah,
like, they're going to follow us home.
I mean, there may not be any food. Really, really creeped me out.
And I couldn't understand her at the time. You know, we're supposed to be hospitable. What's wrong with you? Hey, we just met some awesome people. Let's go have some fun. And she's Debbie Downer all the way home. By the time they get there, there's undercurrent. It's a cold atmosphere when they come in. She's trying to get things cleaned up. I'm trying to cover over the tension. It never seemed to work.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out what is wrong with my wife.
I'm so glad that my wife is actually not a part of this conversation right now, because I feel like you're talking about me and the things that I've done to my introvert wife. So I understand. Yeah.
Part of what breaks down is we wanted to be heard without hearing. And it took us a long time to figure out that two people can't yell at each other and build a relationship.
Yes.
So I'm disappointed. I'm embarrassed how long it took us to figure out how to hear the other person. When I finally understood your point, it wasn't you wouldn't be hospitable. It's that off the cuff left you embarrassed.
Right, exactly. And for him, it was like, this is great, you know. But for me, I felt like I was being run over. That I'm like, much like your wife, an introvert. I don't really like having someone just come into my home and seeing everything that, you know, I want to hide things, even if they're not bad things. I want to put my best foot forward. And so all those things became very stressful for me.
So we figured out, Adam, how to solve that. Again, it took us a few years.
Okay, yeah.
God help us. We would just pre-plan spur of the moment, meaning I finally heard her. She said, look, if you think you might invite somebody, if we're not even sure, but you might, let's just have food ready, the house prepared, and I'll assume you'll do your spur of the moment thing. So we had pre-planned spur of the moment opportunities.
Right.
And so when I did it, you know, off cuff, we were ready. She was ready. They actually experienced a couple who cared about each other and could care about them.
Exactly.
And I think that sounds silly. As people are listening, they probably think, how dumb are you? But it took us a while to get to those things. And that's an example. And we're telling a light one. Obviously, it went deep in some financial issues, family dysfunction, and some woundedness we brought in with us. We had challenges. We could talk spiritually, openly to others better than we could ourselves. By the time we got married, the conflict made it difficult to pray for each other. It's surprising. You would think that stuff would all be easy. It's just not. So anyhow, here we are talking about how unhappy we got.
Yeah. Oh, no. And I think I really appreciate you sharing that part, because I think as listeners, it's so easy to convince ourselves they don't understand my marriage. Like, they don't understand what brokenness looks like. And so honestly, that was so good. Even honestly, myself listening to the both of you was encouraged by that. And I think so often it is the most simple things. It's like, shouldn't we know this by now? Like, why doesn't she know this? And why doesn't he know this? And sometimes it's the most basic thing. So I really appreciate you sharing that part of things. The second happy. So that's the book. What is the second happy? And you talk about these seven practices. Hop in and kind of share the heartbeat behind the book.
Yes. Our journey that you helped us just describe, Adam, is the framework for probably everybody's marriage. If you're the 1% who got married, you were happy, and you've always been happy, then go write a book for the rest of us.
Absolutely.
But the rest of us
we want to know.
Yeah. The rest of us had an after the honeymoon this season. Or these years went really bad. We got unhappy. And the imagery that came to us was a lot of people, it was like our houses. You know, we bought a house, we fell in love with it. It was a dream home. We bought it, we lived in it, but we found its flaws after a while. And when you find its flaws, the flaws start to annoy you. And eventually all you experience is the flaws.
Yes.
And so you sell that house to go buy another one. And we can treat marriage the same way. But the new movement in this nation is, why don't you renovate your house? And we did that. We had a house for several years, and it got old, and we got tired of it, and there were things that were not well designed. And we decided to renovate the house. And when we did, we fell back in love with the same house.
Yes.
When you make an investment in something and build it, when you renovate your marriage, if you'll invest back into your marriage, you can rebuild it, renovate it, and fall back in love with the same person. And there is a richness in this that is being lost in marriage, but found in houses. And we're saying, hey, go renovate your marriage. That's what now you can find a second happy. We found a second happy with our same house, and we found the same thing with our marriage. It's better, it's richer, it's deeper.
Right.
And I'm the extrovert, so I'm talking too much, but you get the idea.
Yeah. And you just don't quit on it. I mean, selling a house means that you'd quit on that house. And this with marriage, it's the same. You can be happy. Continuing to quit doesn't really get you that deeper life that you really are looking for.
Yeah. This is so hopeful. So those specific practices, if that's me, walk us through, what does that look like practically? One or two of those practices.
Okay. So practice one, break the quit cycle. Practice two, get your hands up. Practice three, pick a fair fight.
Oh, jeez.
Practice four, take a knee or two. Practice five, don't settle for the hollow Easter bunny. Practice six, evict the elephant. And practice seven, choose your bucket wisely. They're really good practices, but they don't just jump out at you, because you're like, what? What does that mean?
Yeah, when she reads
as
those,
I'm reading them, I'm like, they probably aren't telling him a whole lot right there.
It's great. It's
actually
great.
We don't want it to. We want you to say, what is that? And draw you in, because once you get it, the imagery is persistently practical.
Right.
So get your hands up is prayer. And we draw from Exodus 17. But pick a fair fight, everybody gets.
Yes.
So let's talk about that for a couple of minutes. Because I think practically, people don't know how to fight fair, Adam.
Yes.
And so they either fight dirty or they quit fighting.
Right.
And both of those will leave you in a permanently unhappy relationship. So when you fight dirty, it means you're taking pot shots. Here's the curious thing about fair fights. Fair fights are scheduled. They have rules. They have boundaries. They intend to help you walk through rounds. Like it's a round one, take a break. Round two, take a break. We took all of that. And by our 10th year, we figured out we don't know how to fight, but we've been doing a lot of it.
Yeah. At least resolve them.
Yeah. We know how to fight. We just do either fight dirty and then we just vomit our feelings and move on.
Right.
And so our discovery was, and I think it's true right now. In fact, this is a sidebar, Adam, but the COVID season has only revealed that people want first and foremost to be heard. But if that's all you do is get heard, you never hear. And if everybody's screaming to be heard and you do that in your marriage, you will be as polarized and divided as our society is right now.
Yes.
It's not winnable. So the art of a fair fight is a commitment to not merely be heard, but to hear. So we break it into three stages, if you will. Stage one is communication, and it has four rounds. Stage two is compromise. It has four rounds. Stage three is counseling. It has four rounds.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to detail all that, or that'll take the rest of our time. But if somebody's listening right now, it immediately should trigger, oh, I don't even think through how we fight.
Right.
I don't know how to call for a fair fight, which, by the way, when Marsha or I want a fair fight, you have to go to the person, say, I want to call a fair fight. Here's the issue. And you don't fight. You set a time. Vomiting your feelings at the moment is just to be heard. But there's no communication in this.
Right.
So to really love someone, you have to care enough to hear them. And you don't feel loved until you are heard. And you don't love until you hear. So the whole first stage of communication, because I keep talking, which you can tell, and I did that in our marriage early on. We would have a fight. I would talk until I was tired of talking. He would be silent. I would think I'm right. And I was.
I would suffer in silence. I'm just very stubborn. So even if he thought he won, in my head, I was, you know, like, no, you may be able to out-talk me, but I still have my own position and I'm standing my ground.
And she did. And I'm like, why are you so stubborn?
Right.
Every fight we have, every time we schedule a fair fight, Adam, she gets to go first and I have to be quiet. And it's difficult for her to speak and it's difficult for me to shut up. And while I'm listening, I'm not reloading. I'm listening.
Right.
Round one, she speaks, I listen. Round two, I say back to her what she said.
Oof.
And if I did not do it with heart and clarity so that she could sense I felt what she meant, we go back to round one until I can honor round two. Then round three is I speak and she listens. And round four is she has to say what I said.
Mm-hmm.
Those first four, the majority of couples never achieve the skill, the art, or the heart of communication. So they always try to solve it with compromise before they communicate, and it never works.
A question with you, Marsha. Did your parents fight well? Did you see that displayed well?
That's a good question. No. To be honest, no. There was a lot of passive aggressive. One person stating their side and the other one being quiet. So, and honestly, that's kind of how I thought that's how you should do it. And
yeah.
So I was the quiet one who would just, you know, become stubborn. And this whole fair fight thing really helped me break that barrier of stubbornness inside that tore that down and allowed me to be able to speak my mind when I knew I was safe enough that I wasn't going to get, you know, rolled over. So it was hard for him, but it was also very hard for me.
Oh, no, no doubt. Thank you. Thank you for answering that. Cause so my wife and I, we are one of the strange couples that we both have amazing examples of a great marriage. And yet I look back and I've told my parents this before, it almost appeared too good in my situation. And I can remember early on when Becky and I started arguing, I thought something was horribly wrong. I'm like, we're not supposed to argue. Like, we don't do this. And she's like, all couples argue. And I'm like, no, that's not true. My parents never argue. And so I can remember asking my parents, like, did you guys really never argue? And they're like, they both started laughing. They're like, we argued really well behind closed doors.
Right.
And I'm like, what? Cause my parents are the people that you would catch making out in the back of a pickup on a public street when I was in high school. I'm like, what are you doing? You're so embarrassing. I mean, they're best friends with each other. I'm like, you guys are the most disgusting people ever. But, they're like, Adam, we fought all the time. We just did it behind closed doors. And I almost wish that they would have showed us what it looked like to argue well. And also, I'm grateful, even in the dynamic between the two of you, because it's totally my wife and I, of one person being a talker and the other person like somehow able to not say anything, which is so foreign to me. Like, how can you not say anything? And because of those dynamics, not to mention your background and upbringing, it just creates an absolute disaster. There's so many things that I could talk about. One of the practices, just because I'm curious, evict the elephant. What in the world is that?
Yes.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. I grew up, first of all, I'm going to tease you and then answer it. Let me tease you with this. I grew up in a home where my parents became pregnant in high school, both quit high school. I was the third child by the time they were 20. Oh, wow. We lived in poverty. They divorced when I was about 12 years old, but it was ugly along the way. Now, they came to faith early on. So you got to imagine this. My parents are Christians. My dad's influential in this small church. He's up front. He's on the board. But at home, he's a different person. Oh. And we pretended we were the family who presented ourselves at church. And we looked better than we live.
Wow.
By time I hit my 30s, I realized pretense destroyed my life. So the elephant in the room is the imagery. When there's the elephant in the room and nobody's acknowledging the elephant, when nobody's saying anything, when nobody's telling the truth, when dad volcanically explodes, says things wildly inappropriate, present day would call it abusive, and at times would get abusive. And then we go back to being fine. And we're not fine. Mm-hmm. Nobody's fine. That fine family imagery is a family who has an elephant who has become the family pet. And if you do not evict that elephant, you'll never get honest and open. You'll never have authenticity in the marriage or the family. And way too many families have made the elephant in the room the family pet, and you got to evict them. Oh. There you go.
Yeah, and it's not only those very tragic things. It can be a smaller, maybe not smaller, but I'm thinking of when we got married, financially, my home was very stable. You know, we didn't have too much, a ton, but we had plenty always financially. We were able to, I never even thought about money, to be honest. So when we got married, money became, just because he was a pastor starting out, we didn't make much money.
Yep.
I wanted a lot of kids. He worried about providing for the kids. I kept saying, oh no, money's no problem. It'll just be there. You know, why are you worried about the money? You shouldn't be worried about money. We'll be fine. You know, like it couldn't be a problem. And finally, what we ended up doing was I took over the finances for a while, and all of a sudden my eyes were opened. It's like, oh, wait a minute. This doesn't add up here. I kept thinking I was going to be able to show him how to do it, when the truth was we didn't have the money that I thought we did. And so that elephant in the room got dissolved by that in situation where we addressed it. And so there's lots of things like that.
You guys need to keep writing books together because I need to read them with my wife. Like the two of us, I feel like I'm listening to Adam and Becky Weber in some bizarre way.
Well, actually, Becky called us and said, you say a couple of these things?
Here, say this to the bald bearded man. We all want to evict the elephant that our spouse has. Any word of advice on coming to terms with our elephant? Because it's always the other person who's got elephants.
Right. It is. And we're very specific about that in this chapter. We don't simply talk in concept. We get concrete. And then we go specific illustrations. And we say, if you don't acknowledge that everybody has elephants, number one, so it's not something to shame you. It's something to acknowledge. Secondly, you have to own your elephant. When somebody else has to point out the elephant, that is the elephant. So one of the primary elephants is that you require the other person to point it out. If you would own your elephant before anybody else, authenticity and emotional intimacy enter the room at high speed because now trust is possible. Right. So when I have an elephant and I won't acknowledge it, she doesn't even intuitively know why she can't trust me, but it's because I don't tell the truth. If you don't tell the truth about yourself and you only tell the truth about others, you are not a trustworthy person.
Right. And I think a lot of, you know, when someone brings up an elephant and you're like, no, spending time with God and examining yourself before you start denying it and praying about it, I think goes a long way to it evaporating and you actually, your eyes clearing and you can see what, you know, the elephant basically.
Yeah, no, that is so good. Again, the book is called The Second Happy. If you're driving, pull over to the side of the road before you order it. But genuinely, I want to challenge every couple that's married to get a copy of this book. Kevin and Marcia, so grateful for the time with the both of you. Thank you for allowing the pretty parts and the not so pretty parts of your marriage minister to so many others. The Conversation with Adam Weber is produced by the Converge Podcast Network and proudly distributed on Faith Radio. Special thanks to these partners. For more information on this show, visit convergepodcast.com.
This show is part of the Converge Podcast Network.